Welcome. Today I have the great honor of interviewing Mr. Tim Judah. He is a British reporter and political analyst for The Economist. And he has written several books, mainly focusing on Serbia and Kosovo. At the time of the Euromaidan revolution, he began reporting from Ukraine. I'd like to begin by taking this opportunity to thank you for doing this interview. And I'd like for you to begin by telling our audience more about the significance and the impact of the work that you do as an author and journalist for The Economist.
Well, I work for other people apart from The Economist, but my kind of mainstay, perhaps you could say, is with The Economist. And I do mostly Balkan stuff for The Economist. I think the kind of significance and the impact is, well, it's hard to measure those, so it's sort of subjective, really. But I mean, one thing I'm very happy about is that The Economist is one of the few serious publications left which still publishes anything about the Balkans. You know, most serious publications do very little about this part of the world. So I just think it's important to keep this part of the world covered, and I'm happy that The Economist continues to do that. When it comes to being an author, of course, writing books is just one way of telling a kind of much deeper story and telling different stories and longer stories which you can't fit into a magazine or you can't fit into a newspaper article. And that's why I wrote recently a book about Ukraine, because like in the last two, 3 years, I spent much more of my time in Ukraine. And I wrote a book called In Wartime, Stories from Ukraine, because I was able to then explore part of the history of the country and also kind of give space to ordinary people to explain what they think and how they view the world. The beauty of a book, and therefore sort of being an author, is being able to tell those stories at some length and to fill a gap, really, which was my intention with the book.
And with your experience and your expertise, what would you say are some of the most rewarding and challenging aspects associated with the journalistic work that you have done?
I always wanted to be a journalist, and I wanted to be a journalist because I was interested in history and I wanted to see the first draft of history, the source, or history being made, perhaps I should say. So in that sense, you know, I've been very happy and I've been very lucky that to a great extent I've been able to do that. The most rewarding thing, or one of the most rewarding things, is that not having to sit in an office all day and not having to go to an office 9 to 5. And in the way that my career has panned out, you know, it has advantages and disadvantages, but one advantage is that I can do a lot of what I like to do and I don't have to do a lot of stuff which I don't really want to do. So that's kind of, you know, one advantage.
Certainly, and I want to mention that as the program editor of Global Horizons at the NATO Association of Canada, what I do is I interview diplomats, government officials, journalists, and influential members of the international community. And over the past 8 months, I've been provided with an opportunity to do these interviews. And as a result of pursuing journalism, I've learned such an immense amount. Every day that I do the job, I learn something new. And I'm looking forward to continuing on with the NATO Association of Canada. My background is mainly in legal studies and government. I completed my bachelor's in legal studies at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. And following that, I completed my master's in public service. Now I'm in the process of completing my law degree through University of London's international program. And I strongly feel that I want to pursue journalism. It's something that I love, and it's something that I see myself doing long term. And for those who are perhaps interested in pursuing a career in journalism, what would you say is the best advice that you can provide to our listeners who are, you know, thinking about it at this point?
I think it depends on, you know, what type of journalism you're interested in. I mean, there's like there's a lot of different types of journalism. You might be interested in covering celebs or Hollywood, or you might be interested in writing about film or TV, or you might be interested in writing about domestic politics, and you might be interested in news, or you might be interested in kind of feature writing. So there's kind of, journalism covers a whole gamut of things. But if you're interested in foreign affairs, I mean, frankly, the best thing to do at the beginning of a career is just to sort of go somewhere and set yourself up. I think probably that's a thing to do. I think if it's just very difficult, especially in this climate now where there's kind of less money for foreign coverage. There's just kind of much less opportunities to sort of to be sent somewhere by a newspaper or a magazine or a broadcasting organisation. And so there's much more demand for freelance coverage, and therefore the best thing is to do is to go and set up somewhere in a place where you think that there's going to be news and you're going to be able to support yourself. I think that's probably the best thing to do.
I think that's very valuable advice, and I strongly agree with you. In terms of youth becoming more involved in making a difference in international relations, global affairs, and diplomacy, what would you say the young professionals out there should do when it comes down to engaging in the latest news feeds and the latest news that gets released? We're bombarded by social media, and, you know, today's society, a lot of our young professionals get news feeds from, you know, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, television. But I oftentimes emphasize the importance of picking up a newspaper and reading the news as opposed to relying so heavily on social media.
So a lot of stuff on social media is rubbish, or it's instant reactions, or it's just wrong, or it's a disinformation, even of one sort or another. So the best thing to do is, social media, of course, has its place and a big place. But I mean, otherwise, the fact is that if you're interested in a certain area or a certain subject, well, read up about it, whether it's in newspapers or books. But you can't be an expert or know much about a place or about a subject just by relying on social media.
No, this is true. And with your background and your expertise, I have to say that I'm honored to be a participant here in Montenegro. It's been nothing but a pleasure attending the To Be Secure Forum. I wanted to mention that you were involved in a discussion yesterday. You presented the work that you've done in the past, and I found your discussion not only engaging, but you provided an opportunity for a lot of the youth to ask questions. And I want you to discuss the talk that you gave all of the participants, especially the young professionals yesterday.
I was talking about my book, which was published in Britain last December, will be published in the US in October. And it's called, but I think I'm saying that because I think that Canada actually is covered by the British publication, the British version of the book. But anyway, my book is called In Wartime, Stories from Ukraine. And what I wanted to do there was really to fill the gap. What struck me was that for such a big and important country, the second biggest country in Europe after Russia, 45 million people, strategically important, there was just so little out there. I mean, if you just wanted to read up about Ukraine, you could find one or two history books, serious, dense history books, one or two books about Ukrainian politics. But there was not much which was kind of really kind of readable, which brought the country to life, which brought people to life, and which gave people an impression of what Ukrainians were really like and what Ukraine is like and what Ukrainians think. So that's really what I wanted to do with the book. So that's really it. It's a mixture of some history, because it's not you don't need a new history of Ukraine. I mean, those exist. But what I wanted to do was to sort of highlight certain parts of history which are important for understanding what is happening today. That was one part. I mean, of course, I talked to politicians. There was reportage from the front covering the war in the East. And then, you know, a lot of discussion with ordinary people, because they're just like not part of the equation, really, as far as much of the literature goes. And Ukraine is all too often treated as a sort of subject. It's in the sense that should Ukraine become part of NATO, or should it be left to a Russian sphere of influence? We forget that, you know, Ukraine is full of people who want to have a view and say on the future of their country, and that you couldn't really read much about that. So that's what I wanted to do.
I want to mention that I had an opportunity to attend the Toronto International Film Festival, And at this festival, I met the director of Ukraine's Winter on Fire. The filmmaker, Evgeny Avnevsky, talked about some of the challenges that Ukrainian people face on a daily basis. And I encourage everyone to watch this film because it shows the struggles that Ukrainian people go through every single day. It's one thing to, you know, to hear about what's going on, but then it's another thing to, you know, obtain information from a journalist, from someone who's actually experienced, who's seen the region, who's written about the ongoing struggles in Ukraine, and to then reflect on, you know, perhaps what steps should be taken next, what more can be done. So I oftentimes advise the youth to turn to professionals, to look at, to watch movies done by filmmakers who actually filmed the movie while in Ukraine, to read publications that are out there about Ukraine by authors and by journalists who actually went to Ukraine. You know, I think that's so important.
Of course.
You know? And where do you see the future of Ukraine?
I think that what's happened actually is that the focus of the fight for Ukraine, the battle for Ukraine, has shifted. And whereas before it was this kind of, that was actually this kind of active war in the East, I think that that's turning into a frozen conflict, or has turned into a frozen conflict, and that could last for years, could last for a generation, just like other frozen conflicts in the region of the former Soviet Union. I think that what's happened is that the real battle for Ukraine is in Kiev, and it's between reformers and fake reformers, effectively. And we've seen a new government come to power, but the question is whether that's... I mean, many people regard that as a less reforming government, or a government which is going to be less committed to reform than the last one. But this is really where the struggle is. I like to quote the example of Moldova. In Moldova, a wise analyst once said to me, we don't have pro-European politicians and pro-Russian politicians in Moldova. We have pro-Russian crooks and pro-European crooks. And in Moldova, what's happened is that the pro-European crooks have been in power for the last couple of years and have stolen so much money that if there was an election today, then the pro-Russian crooks would come to power. And I like to quote that because although it's kind of a small example, it is actually a kind of model for Ukraine in the sense that if the pro-Russian crooks stall reform, steal over more money, then Putin really doesn't have to do anything, and that Ukraine will basically fall back into its arms eventually. So that's really where the struggle is. And the fact is that the pressure has to be kept up on Ukraine, both the Ukrainian authorities, the government, both domestically and externally. It's the incumbent on foreign governments, Western governments, and especially the Canadian government, actually, because Canadian government actually is plays a much bigger role in Ukraine than it does in many other countries, obviously because of this kind of the links, thanks to the large Ukrainian diaspora. But it means that Canada's voice is listened to, I think, in a way that it gives Canada much more importance in Ukraine than it would have in other countries. So Canada actually has a role to play, and it has been playing an important role. But it's so there's that international aspect, and then there's the domestic aspect, helping those parts of civil society which keep up the pressure. I mean, they call it the sandwich in Ukraine. So, you know, the authorities being in the middle between the foreign pressure and between those civil society organizations, which are doing good work and keeping up the pressure.
You also engaged in the forum today by taking part in the third panel called Russia's Geopolitical Awakening, Game Changer. You moderated this entire panel. Throughout the entire discussion that place, what do you think Russia's next move will be as a result of Montenegro becoming a member of NATO?
I think that kind of actually the Russians are kind of more or less reconciled to the fact that Montenegro is going to join NATO. It strategically makes no difference at all. It's so small and militarily insignificant. I think they're much more interested in concentrating now on Serbia if they can, and
well, they certainly can concentrate on it. Whether it will kind of yield pro-Russian results or not is another another matter. But I think that more or less they've decided there's not much they can do about Montenegro. And what happens with Russia in general in the future, of course, is something that very few people know. In fact, I would hazard a guess that actually there's only one person who knows, and that's Vladimir Putin himself. And exactly. That there are a lot of people who pretend to know what is in Putin's head or pretend to know what he's going to do next. But I don't buy it. I think there's only one person in control, and only he knows what he's going to do next.
Absolutely. I want to, again, sincerely thank you for doing this interview. I immensely enjoyed listening to you yesterday, and I enjoyed watching you moderate the panel today.
Thank you for inviting me to do this.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.